King of the Worshipers! Where's all of my praises? I want everybody around the world to put your hands together because all the praise belongs to God. Here we go.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. I'm broadcasting, but not video streaming today. We're going to talk about how to slow down and reverse the aging in your brain. We're also going to talk about how to help with dementia prevention and reversal. We're going to talk about a lot of social issues today, including how the official unemployment rate is a complete myth, and all the major media reporting it should be shunned because they're passing on propaganda and they very well have the resources to prove the unemployment rate is much higher. In fact, how about 500% higher? 500%, that's how far off they are. Also, thinking dangerously, I believe that we should be helping students in our educational systems to become critical thinkers. And today, being a critical thinker, an independent thinker, is a dangerous concept. I'll share my thoughts as well as those of Professor Henry Giroux today. Also, a lot of people are familiar with Neil deGrasse. Well, did you know his new food evolution documentary? My personal opinion, it's a blatant case of Monsanto corporate propaganda. I'll share that. Also, there's a big movement out right now and going into the new year to help stop suicide. I would support that. Any reasonable person would. However, a closer look by Martha Rosenberg, and it's showing us that the stop suicide is just helping Big Pharma, because these are all AstroTurf groups, meaning they have nice-sounding, plausible, and empathetic names to their foundations, but behind it is just a way of getting you to take more drugs. I'll go into that. Also today, I'm going to share something about McDonald's in our audio clip. I'm also going to share what one lawyer, who we have researched with our lawyers, and our team believes that he is telling us the truth. Now, I do not support the network he's on. I don't even support the show that he said this on. But I believe that this information is crucial that we understand it, that right now it is my personal and professional belief that there has been a slow-moving coup de grace in the United States, and people are not aware of it. We'll try to share that awareness. So we have a lot to share, including the latest from a board-certified physician on why vaccines have been proven neither safe nor effective. Then why aren't we told this? We'll share that. So we have a lot to put in today's program. Oh, and yesterday afternoon I got an emergency personal phone call from someone that I know who's has a very serious illness in the family. And I said I would help, but the person says, well, they can't take the time to get help. But they're sure they can recover on their own. All they have to do is just follow some protocol. It's not that simple. And today I'm going, if time permits, I'm going to play some audio clips of what is possible because people have done it. But there's an understanding of why the average person on their own will not be able to reverse the disease process. They can make an effort, but rarely to succeed. I'll explain what is happening in a way that you haven't heard before. Let's begin from two universities. First, the University Hospitals of Geneva, which is in Switzerland, and University of Navarra, which is in Spain. They wanted to take a look at the best scientific literature. They found 30 studies in just a 2-year period on sugared sweetened drinks. And they found that they're definitely linked to overweight and obesity in children and adults. And this was published in Obesity Facts, which is a major journal. It's the Journal of European Association for the Study of Obesity. And there's a whole team who wrote this up. And, quote, the evidence-based link with sugar-sweetened beverages with obesity and overweight in children and adults has grown substantially in the past 3 years. We're able to include 30 new studies not sponsored by the industry in this review, an average of 10 per year. And it goes on to say that the evidence is overwhelming. And because there were 244,651 participants in this new study. Now, why is this important? Because people in this audience will say, well, of course, we know that. You may. But I can promise you 95% of the world's population does not. Now, they may know that it may not be great for them, but there's a difference in a person's mind when they don't know that something's bad and dangerous versus not just being good. I mean, people can eat popcorn. Popcorn's not bad, but it's not good. It's just virtually neutral. It's a non-caloric input that's going to be digested, has plenty of fiber. It can stop the appetite, but it's neither good nor bad. That's different than eating something that is a known bad, will cause inflammation, and then you have any myriad of conditions that may respond to excessive inflammation and excessive cytokine roaring through the system. Arthritis, macular degeneration, diabetes, dementia, cancer, erosion of your arterial lining, all that from just having a pizza or even a cup of coffee or a donut or a bagel or a sandwich. Think how many people have ham sandwiches. They're used to it. They like the taste of it. Well, what if it's bad? Do we stop it? The answer is not likely. So the issue is not, do these sugared beverages cause obesity and diabetes, and with that, heart disease and cancer and diabetes? The answer is yes, it will. But the preponderance of the scientific evidence now is what it was with cigarette smoking. For 100 years, the tobacco industry got away with promoting cigarettes as not only safe, but effective in helping relieve stress, soothe your throat. These are actual ads. And because there was competing doctors, one for Chesterfields and one for Lucky Strikes, how many thousands, tens of thousands of doctors recommended? What does it mean that those doctors who recommended smoking something that wasn't, should have been aware that it was toxic, take any responsibility? Morally, they should. But in our society, we never hold those who have harmed us responsible. When it's an institution like medicine, if they're using a wrong procedure, it might take 30 to 35 years before they finally stop it. And the proof of, look how many people knew that cigarettes are bad and still smoke. So the fact that we have proven something dangerous doesn't mean that we're going to make an automatic change in our habits. It doesn't happen that way. It should. But now no one can say, well, the science is not in. Well, there's still some controversy. Well, shouldn't we do another study? The answer is no. We have all these studies. The evidence is overwhelming. Sugar-sweetened beverages, the ones that the average person consumes, are dangerous. Now, something else that we had best pay attention to this time of year is, this comes from the University of Helsinki, and for over 70 years, forward-thinking physicians have noted the association between vitamin C deficiency and pneumonia. Now, pneumonia is a very serious condition, and people die from it. The medical literature written as early as 1936 showed that physicians credited vitamin C with favorably influencing outcomes in pneumonia patients. Now, mind you, that's a long time ago, and I actually remember speaking with Dr. Dean Burke, one of the founders of the National Cancer Institute. I'm guessing he was in his 70s when I was in my 20s and interviewed him. He's passed some long time ago. And I had this conversation that if vitamin C impacts cancer, and you're saying it does, and Albert St. Georgi, who I interviewed, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering ascorbic acid, says vitamin C impacts cancer, and it does, and Dr. Stone, it does, and Dr. Linus Pauling, it does, then why aren't we using it for other conditions? And I saw this phenomena where we had this idea that if something's proven in one area to prevent a disease, then it automatically stands that it has to be proven again for every single condition in the body. So if you said that vitamin C, 10,000 milligrams a day, could help prevent colorectal cancer, you could not say it does anything for anything else in the body. You would have to do another study on bladder cancer, another on breast cancer, ovarian cancer, brain cancer, lung cancer. You would skin cancers, lymphomas, leukemias. Now, that doesn't make any sense, but that's monotheistic thinking. So when I ask him, would this help people who have a weakened immune system in the wintertime and are susceptible to pneumonia or the flu? And he said, well, I don't have the science on that. I can just tell you that we believe it would prevent cancer. There's a good science on that. By the way, all that science was forgotten once chemotherapy dominated the paradigm. So here's what they found. This new study has found that vitamin C deficiency, where people in good health have vitamin C blood concentration, about 70 micromoles per liter, and moderate vitamin C deficiency can occur at about 23 micromoles, and while severe deficiencies and risk of scurvy appear at concentration around 11 micromoles. Now here's the problem. From optimal vitamin C intake, and I would say that would be between 2,000 and 10,000 milligrams a day, in buffered form, ideally taken with a little bit of smoothie, 2-3 ounces of smoothie, helps get through the hydrochloric acid in your stomach with no problem and gets into your bloodstream. That's ideal. Now, with that, you can help strengthen your immune system, your natural killer cells become more active, and there's a whole lot of white blood cells that are increased because of that vitamin C, so you're better able to fight any virus or bacteria. But a lot of people don't have adequate vitamin C. They think they're getting enough from eating an orange at 30 milligrams when you need 3,000 minimum? No, you're not getting enough. Remember, our body, our liver cannot, by reducing glucose, make vitamin C as many other creatures can. So between having not enough and really deep deficiency where you're suffering from scurvy, most people are asymptomatic. You won't see it. Now, you can find when you're fatigued, when you bruise easily, when wounds don't heal, when scratches and cuts that normally would reconnect with fibroblast cells and you'd have a scab and then you'd have new skin, when it lasts weeks or months. By the way, that's also a symptom of hepatitis C when you don't heal from wounds. Then you're in deficiency, but you don't know how deficient you are. Are you really majorly deficient? And there's no one testing for this in medicine. You'll never go to a doctor who'll say, you have this flu-like symptom, you have fatigue, you're not healing, let's check your vitamin C levels. So what they're finding is now that when you have a low vitamin C in your body, you're far more likely to have pneumonia. And when you have a lot of vitamin C, you're far less likely. And there was a review published in the March issue of Nutrients by Dr. Harry, H-A-R-R-I, Hemilia, H-E-M-I-L-A, at the University of Helsinki, and he noted three different controlled trials found that vitamin C significantly protected against pneumonia, reducing the risk of pneumonia by 80%. 80%. Now, we're told to take the flu vaccine to protect against pneumonia. Well, in point of fact, the flu vaccine doesn't protect against pneumonia, and 90% of the people who are dying each year in America are dying of pneumonia, not the flu. Very few people die of the flu. It's in the hundreds or low thousands, like 1,300, 1,200. They're saying 36,000, but they're combining pneumonia with influenza. They're not looking at them two separate conditions, and they should. So if you want to reduce your risk of pneumonia, according to this study, then increase the amount of vitamin C. Now, they say here, quote, in one study involving pneumonia patients, researchers found that a dosage of vitamin C ranging from 500 milligrams to 1,600 milligrams a day cut hospital duration by a third. Well, that would be way, way under what I would suggest for anyone in a hospital. Why? Why should you be taking vitamin C every day? I take it 10 times a day. I believe most people should take it a minimum of 6 because it doesn't last long in your system. It's simple. Vitamin C stimulates the immune system and promotes the function of phagocytes. Phagocytes. Google them. Look them up. Phagocytes. But the increased need for vitamin C in times of illness, in times of stress, physical stress, like training for a marathon, or working too long hours, or not getting enough sleep at night, or being around computers, that's when you need it. So get enough vitamin C every day. The scientific literature is there in major abundance. In fact, one study, participants with colds were given 4,000 milligrams or 8,000 milligrams a day of vitamin C, and the group that received 8 grams a day enjoyed a 19% reduction in the length of their colds, roughly double the 4 gram. And in a review published in the Journal of the Royal Society of Medicine, the authors noted that, quote, we shouldn't be afraid of megadosing because these are unfounded allegations, and recommended that patients with pneumonia take dosages as high as 100 grams a day of vitamin C. With that, you'd have to be taking an intravenous, but we should be doing a lot more intravenous vitamin C. It's very effective against cancer, AIDS, and Lyme's disease. So, just something to think about. Green MedInfo research group has just published a study on mistletoe. Now, mistletoe, this is a time of year where people use mistletoe for some ritual of romance. But the reality is that mistletoe has a long history of medicinal applications among ancient cultures. So some modern scientists are exploring its use as a treatment for colon cancer. And so, by the way, just to set the record straight on this, the tradition of kissing under the mistletoe at Christmas can be tracked back to ancient Scandinavian rules of war. So the story goes that if enemies found themselves standing beneath the mistletoe, they had to lay down their arms for the rest of the day. So peacekeeping led to the Christmas kissing tradition. And it's said that a young man may kiss a young woman under the mistletoe. And so that's the background on it. But then you look at the University of Adelaide in Australia, and researchers there experimented with an extract of mistletoe, and the lab study focused on whether mistletoe could complement or replace chemotherapy as a treatment for colon cancer. Just a little background, colon cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in the United States, according to the CDC. So the scientists did this, mistletoe versus chemotherapy on colon cancer cells, and they found that one of the mistletoe extracts forms a species called Fraxini, F-R-A-X-I-N-I, which grows on ash trees, was more potent against colon cancer cells and cell cultures compared with chemotherapy. And Fraxini was also found to be less harmful to healthy cells. So listen carefully to what I just said. A mistletoe extract from a specific tree, which grows on ash tree, F-R-A-X-I-N-I, was more potent at killing colorectal cancer cells in this study than chemotherapy. Now, for many years, European doctors have considered mistletoe extracts a viable alternative treatment for various cancers, but not in the United States. In fact, one German study published in the Journal of Alternative Therapies in Health and Medicine looked at the effects of Iscador, I-S-C-A-D-O-R, which is another extract of mistletoe, in over 10,000 patients. And the researchers found that patients suffering with colon cancer, rectal cancer, and stomach and breast cancers treated with Iscador extract survived 40% longer than the control group. And Iscador is generally regarded as a complementary cancer therapy. But researchers noted it's the most commonly used oncological drug in Germany. In fact, a subsequent study found that mistletoe extract can improve overall survival in ovarian cancer patients. And another study found that mistletoe may act synergistically in the treatment of pancreatic cancer. So, mistletoe has been around a long time. It was traditionally used as an antispasmodic for treating convulsive coughing and asthma attacks, but it's also been treating epilepsy, digestive and erectile cramps. So, something that you would know now that could help you. And finally, from the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, soy protein eaten early in life can help prevent bone loss in adulthood. So we've been promoting milk, which is a lie, but soy protein, I'm talking about non-genetically engineered soy, is what's needed for strong, healthy bones in adulthood. This was published in the very respectable FASEB journal, which is a group of scientific reports. And use your soy protein isolates that can help prevent bone loss during childhood. Oh, by the way, if you like your raw organic chocolate, good, because from Brown University, they have found that the tantalizing delight of chocolate, a number of recent studies employing various methods have suggested that compounds in cacao called flavanols could benefit cardiovascular health. And now a systematic review of 19 separate randomized controlled trials on cacao, chocolate, found, yes, it's correct. This was published in the Journal of Nutrition. It was an assessment of the combined evidence from all 19 of these trials and focused on whether consuming the flavanol-rich cacao chocolate was associated with improvements in specific circulating biomarkers of cardiometabolic health as compared to consuming a placebo that was with negligible cacao flavanol content. And it did. It made a difference. So have your chocolate. Ideally, if you want the benefit of therapeutic levels, 60% and above. All right. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health and healing. We're 23 minutes into our program. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. Please stay with us. Well, if you're like me, you love the music, and be honest, when you hear some of this music playing in our breaks, your body just automatically goes with the groove, right? I had so much fun at our last dance party in the fall, and I look forward to having another one in the spring when I come back off doing all the work I'm doing now. I also want to mention from our public health segment that the flu vaccine for 2017, well, it's ineffective against the upcoming severe flu season, the experts are warning. And according to an international team of experts, as reported in natural health. This year's flu season is going to be a doozy, and the flu vaccine will most likely prove to be, quote, a total failure at protecting the public. An unusually severe season has already racked up a record number of Australian flu victims, and with the virus making its way into the northern hemisphere, experts warned that we're going to have the same thing here. And then they went in to explain why this was the perception, and this was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. This whole international medical team of researchers evaluated the efficacy of the flu vaccine employed for this year, last year, 2017, and they came up with the reasons. So what can you do? Here's my suggestion. Number one, I mentioned a few moments ago, vitamin C enhances production and functions of the disease-fighting T lymphocytes. With proven abilities to rev up your immune system, vitamin C should be the first weapon in your defense arsenal. And I'm talking about high doses of this wonderful antioxidant. It can dramatically reduce acute cold and flu symptoms. And I had on some time ago Dr. Thomas Levy, and I'll have him back on, talking about megadosing and what he has found in his own practice. Very beneficial. He's suggesting a minimum of 1 to 5 grams a day. That's for healthy people who are doing everything else right. I'm suggesting you could also increase with ascorbyl palmitate 3 grams a day, and then regular buffer vitamin C at about 7 or 8. So you're up around 10. Also, quercetin, 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 that you get it in onions, you get it in apples, it can stop the spread of viruses. In fact, when I haven't had someone stop me on the street in a long time. I was walking up from Lincoln Center. They're closing the Lincoln Center Theater there because they're not renewing their lease, and that's unfortunate because that's one of my favorite places to go. But myself and a lot of other people, and I saw a wonderful movie called 1945. I highly recommend it. I won't tell you anything about it, except it tells you a story of what happens when people spread rumors without having facts. And this is back in 1945, post-war. Anyhow, it's just one of these little theaters, and there's so few of them now. And it's a shame to see that go. So I'm walking back up, and a guy comes over, and he says, he was in a restaurant, jumps up, comes over. He said, "I just saw you standing out there." He said, "Do you remember me?" And I said, "No, I'm sorry, I don't." He said, "I was one of the people that came up to the Tri-State Healing Center and was given some really big doses of vitamin C. It would take 4 hours to get the whole drip. And all the other people in my support system said it was all nonsense. Well, I did that for about a year. And I'm alive and well, and have had nothing wrong with me, not even a cold since then. And I had full-blown AIDS. And every one of those people in my support system who just wanted to take the drugs, they're all dead. I'm alive. And it's too bad that the politics within the gay community and the AIDS community would not allow the truth to come out about natural ways of helping us. But I haven't forgotten," he says. And I just mentioned to him, I said, "Well, it wasn't just vitamin C you were getting. Do you remember the nurse came in every hour and gave you a glass of bitter melon juice? And in that were all these probiotics, but also quercetin." It just came to my mind when I was mentioning quercetin. And he didn't know what was in the juice. There was a sheet I gave him to show him what was in there. But quercetin's super good for your immune system. And I saw what it did. In fact, Dr. Jawala, who was the head of the Linus Pauling Research Institute, showed me that he was able to kill the HIV cells with just quercetin by itself, very high doses. And that's why I upped the amount of quercetin from 4 to 1 to 1 to 1. So for every gram of vitamin C, I would suggest 1 gram of quercetin, because it's just phenomenal. If you want skin that's going to look younger, longer, quercetin helps recombine the construction of collagen, which is what holds your face up, keeps it from becoming jowly and wrinkled. But quercetin also is phenomenal for killing viruses, hepatitis, herpes, cytomegalovirus, whole lot of viruses. And it's a bioflavonoid. It's an antioxidant. You get it in fruits and vegetables, but if you're sick, you don't get enough of the potent antiviral and anti-inflammatory and immune system boosting effects. It can interfere with the replication and spread of viruses. In one study, 7 days of pre-treatment with quercetin caused mice to significantly be more resilient against influenza. So lots of quercetin, apples, grapes, cranberries, tomatoes, blackberries, onions. That's where you get your quercetin. And by the way, instantly, sharply reducing or eliminating sugar and alcohol is also going to help your immune system. And olive leaf have two different mechanisms against viruses. Olive leaves and olive leaf extract have long been used in herbal medicine to protect against infectious disease. And there is a specific constituent, and it is a, I'll spell it for you, O-L-E-U-R-O-P-E-I-N. And this oleuropein aggressively blocks viral replication by interfering with the protein production of viruses. And olive leaves, not the olive, not olive oil, but the olive leaves have another nifty effect against viruses. Researchers have found that they actively trigger immune cells to engulf and destroy pathogens, which is bad news for any virus cells trying to take hold in your body. And generally, it's, I'm suggesting 500 milligrams to 1,000 milligrams 4 times a day if you're coming down with anything. Just something I wanted to share on that element that we generally don't hear much about. Also, there was a special report from the UN investigator, the rapporteur, on extreme poverty and human rights in the United States. He's a law professor, and he contacted the Obama administration before the presidential election to get permission to undertake a fact-finding mission. He's from Australia to the United States. And after 2 weeks of reporting, he's released his report and calls it an American illusion. Now, he went to places. In fact, all the places he went, I was visiting the same places when I was writing and filming Poverty, Inc. He went to Alabama and San Francisco and Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico and West Virginia. And he talked to poverty experts and civil society organizers and government officials, but just regular people born or thrust into poverty. And in a statement released last week, in an interview for All Things Considered, he shared some of his conclusions, just who are the poor. And I'm very pleased that he at least was honest and not political. Most of the poor in America are working, but they frequently, even after working a full-time job, they still have to get food stamps, or they still have to get some form of public assistance because it's not enough to feed them or house them. Even some families that have two adults working full-time are still poor. And I can confirm this because when I was down in Titusville, Florida, and I went to a place called the Daily Bread that I support, it's a soup kitchen. That's what it is. And the guy in there is a really good, he's a hero in my opinion, because out of his own pocket and from just donations, every day, 7 days a week, he's feeding people. Now, it used to be he'd feed maybe 100, 150, now it's over 400 people. And when I first went there, I went there because the homeless vets I was interviewing in February, it was cold. It was in the 40s. I never will forget this. Boy, some images stick in your mind. And I'm walking in the woods, and here are all these vets in the morning. Most are asleep. A couple had sleeping bags. Some were in little tents. But some had nothing. They were outside. And one guy was just in a T-shirt, and he was curled up like in a fetus position under a tree, and I'm standing there, and I'm not going to film anyone without their permission, so I said, "Fella, do you have any clothes?" And he said, "No." I said, "Why not?" He said, "I'm too poor." "How old are you?" 28. "What brought you here to this camp?" He said, "I heard I'm a vet, and I heard that this was a place where vets come and kind of look after each other, because when you're out there in the street and you're poor, it can get really rough. And for homeless women vets, they're very susceptible to being harassed and raped." He said, "But here, at least there's no harassment. Women are protected. And we just live." And I had this whole conversation for a couple hours with him. And you think, wow, 40 degrees. And he's just got a T-shirt. And all these people had nothing. I mean nothing. One guy had two cans of food. That's it. They were neatly placed on beside a T-shirt that was folded up and a towel that was folded up. And I'm looking at this guy, and he's got blood on his T-shirt. I said, "Friend, I see you got an injury under there." He says, "Oh, it's not an injury." He said, "I just had, you know, some stents put in, and I had something wrong with my heart." So I said, "Well, can I take a look?" And he pulled up his shirt, and I said, "You have an infection there." And so he opened up his pocket and took out a little crumpled piece of paper, and I said, "What's that?" He said, "I'm aware of what I have, but this is a prescription, and I don't have the $57 for the medication. So every day I go over here, it's a two-mile walk, I go over to the ocean, and I go in the ocean, and knowing the salt water would be good for us." I said, "No, just the opposite. You don't want to go in the water with an infection. The water's loaded with bacteria and viruses, and that'll only make it worse." And so I helped him out. I helped the guy with a T-shirt out. When I see these people with CNN and NBC and the networks shooting poverty, I always ask, did they actually stop to help the person in whatever way they could, or they just film and go on? Like, oh, okay, these are the disposables of society. And that bothered me. That's why I helped the Daily Bread. In any case, I went into the Daily Bread, and I'd filmed there and interviewed people, and they get a hot meal, and they can. There is a shower there, the men's shower, women's shower, they can clean up. But more often than not, the people were going to the beach to clean up. And they would take a shower where most people coming out of the water shower off to get the salt off. That's their daily shower. They'd use the restroom there and then go back into the woods. And so I asked this guy who was kind of helping them, "How many are down here?" He said, 16,000. 16,000 homeless, that's just right here. Over 900,000. "Why don't you see them?" He said, "Because it's a game. The only homeless people they ever register are those that have registered in a shelter. But 95% of people will never want to go into a shelter. Shelters, you're going to get everything ripped off. You can get beaten up. And so most people couch surf. They'll find someone, a relative or a friend, and they'll stay with them. Or they'll stay out on the streets. Or they'll stay, you know, at places like this where we're off the grid. But even where we're at, they'll come in with bulldozers and tear down this little camp and throw it all in a pile and burn it. Even your clothes, they'll throw the." And so I said, "Who does this?" "Well, the mayor does it." So there happened to be the mayor. So I went over, and you want to see what I had to say to the mayor? Watch the film. It's free. It's up on Gary Nall's YouTube. American Veterans Forgotten and Betrayed. We have over 900,000 suffering from Gulf War Syndrome, post-traumatic stress disorder, committing suicide at an astronomical rate, three times more than the average citizen or profession, and an awful lot of homeless. And every single administration, every single president, every single Veterans Administration director has abandoned them. They serve their purpose, you know, for the imperialist expeditions, then they're thrown away. That's unfortunate, but that's the way it is. In any case, I want to thank this Sasha Ingber and also Philip Alston for this report because it showed how poor Americans are. Now, it's gotten no publicity, but we have extreme poverty in the United States, where nearly 50 million Americans are suffering from extreme poverty. And then we have poverty. That's another 100 million. So you're at 150 million now. You're approaching about 40% of the entire American population. And we're not doing a single thing for these people. That's something to think about. What should we be doing? Oh, and by the way, these people are frequently impacted by global warming because a lot of them go south in the wintertime, because if you're going to be poor, better be poor when it's warm than poor where it's freezing cold and you could freeze to death overnight. So they go down to Louisiana and Mississippi. Well, now, this is the latest report from Climate News Network. It says climate crisis is to uproot millions of people. Nations need to be ready. And it goes on to talk about how wildfires tearing across Southern California, which they are as we speak right now, largest wildfire in California history, forcing hundreds of thousands of residents to evacuate from their homes, destroying thousands of homes. This is the new norm. And now they're saying hurricanes which slammed Texas and Florida and Louisiana, this is the new norm. And there was an interesting statement in Climate News Network. It says this: you're looking at 300 million people worldwide who are going to be climate victims. But we had, leaving Florida, going up through Alabama and Georgia, finding hotels to stay in, exactly what would happen if this was another country and you had millions of people leaving a state, 7 to 9 million out of Florida alone, and another country says, well, we can't have 7 to 9 million people coming in here. Well, in the United States, you can't prevent people from going into a state from another state. But in other countries, they do. And no one is doing a single thing about how many people each year are displaced by climate change. Well, we now have the figure. And the official figure is 26 million people a year are displaced by climate or weather-related disasters, according to the United Nations. So what should we do? Well, I'll just share one example of what I believe we should do. I believe that in every single susceptible state, that means California, Oregon, Washington, certainly Texas, Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina, those are the most susceptible, not the only ones. We should have, in every one of those states, in every one of your major communities, we should have emergency shelters. Now, these would be built properly. They would be built to withstand flooding or hurricanes. You can do that by using rebar and double instead of one block of cinder block, you use two together and you fill it with concrete and steel. Nothing's going to blow it down. 200 mile an hour wind wouldn't blow it down. You build it up off the ground so it's not flooded, and then in it you put a clinic for people who are coming from nursing homes, assisted living centers, or homes where they need emergency care. You have above ground generators, commercial generators. You have in the ground propane tanks, maybe 100,000 gallons of propane tanks that will feed gas into the into there, because you're not going to have solar when you have these storms. Then you have rooms for families and rooms for singles. You have a large cafeteria where everyone can get food. And then you have emergency services. So if every community in America that was susceptible to weather dramatic effects had that, imagine then what that would mean. So you would go from where you might be susceptible or would be susceptible to a place at least where you're going to be safe, that has been built specifically to protect you. Now, these are not expensive buildings to build. You could build one that would house 20,000 people. And that way they can bring their cars, or there could be public transportation provided to get them there. And then at least for however long they have to be there, there is a facility in each community to help them. Right now, we don't have that. They're using football fields and ice skating rinks. Down in Florida, they use the ice skating rink, which was good, better than being outside, but that doesn't have a cafeteria, medical facility, doesn't have emergency services, doesn't even have phones. You're just in there on the ground with everyone else and one or two bathrooms, which are going to overflow because the moment the septic system gets water up in it, it's going to backflow right back up in. So you design these from the get-go so you have an automatic disposal unit that can carry waste into a larger leach field that's not affected by the current water table. So there's so much you could do. And yet our government is not doing a single thing. And we should be doing the same thing around the world. If we are giving $1.3 billion a year to Egypt, another $1 billion to $2 billion to Pakistan, why not make it exclusively not for weapons, but rather for helping people in their natural disasters, which happen regularly? Just a thought. Now, I want to share a couple other thoughts. Just to let you know, in the new year, I'm going to be having some of the best minds in the world on for interpersonal conversations. The Chris Hedgeses, the Henry Giroux, the people who are critical thinkers. Every week, we'll be having more and more of those conversations. But part of what we're not doing, in my opinion, and this is just short, but something to think about, we're not providing forums for critical thinking. Almost all of our educational forums are passive. We have a teacher who may want a teacher, be a good teacher, good communicator, but what if the curriculum is not? What if the environment is not? And what if the students are not all in alignment and conducive to the learning experience? Then we're not going to help people become critical thinkers. We need, in effect, online webinar discussions with critical thinkers in each field, so that any week you could go to a webinar on critical thinking on the arts, critical thinking on the environment, and have dozens of critical thinking where you have an opportunity to share your points of view, to ask critical questions, and to see in a non-passive way how to sharpen your own skills. And in the present moment, according to Henry Giroux, it becomes particularly important for educators and concerned citizens all over the world to protect and enlarge their critical formation of our culture. And I agree with that. We need to start thinking more critically. Now, here's someone who thinks very critically. I'm going to turn you over now for about 5 minutes. I want you to hear what this lawyer has to say about what's going on right now with one of these investigations. Just information for you to process. Please listen in.
That the Mueller investigation is illegitimate and corrupt. And Mueller has been using the FBI as a political weapon. And the FBI has become America's secret police, secret surveillance, wiretapping, intimidation, harassment, and threats. It's like the old KGB that comes for you in the dark of the night, banging through your door.
By the way, this is not a game. This is not hyperbole you're using here.
No, ask Paul Manafort. They came for him and broke through his front door.
And if it can happen to him, Greg,
it can happen to all of us. Absolutely. The FBI is a shadow government now. It has become highly politicized. Peter Strzok is the perfect example of it. He led both the Hillary Clinton investigation and, until recently, the Mueller investigation. This is a guy who has corrupt political motives. We now know it. The Congress has the emails, but he's the tip of the iceberg. There are others, especially Andrew Weissmann, and as you've pointed out, Jeannie Ray.
Pam, you're the Attorney General of Florida. I have been laying out a case, and it just keeps growing by leaps and bounds. And in fact, I am saying with the surveillance, the unmasking, and the leaking of raw intelligence, We now have some members, and I want to be very clear, I think the vast majority of our intelligence community, our FBI, they are good people that serve us and do a great job and keep us safe. But we have some that are using the powerful tools of intelligence. They have weaponized it, as in the case of General Flynn. And we have now criminalized and politicized at the highest levels, starting with James Comey and Mueller and his band of merry, you know, Trump haters, you know, criminalizing and politicizing the Justice Department and justice in America. How dangerous is this?
Well, Sean, you and Greg have laid out an incredible case every night.
I would agree with what the lawyer said. I believe he is sound. Our own legal experts agree with that. But the fact that you have the truth on your side does not mean that the truth will prevail, because there are other considerations. For example, that was Sean Hannity suggesting how good and honest and loyal the average person working for our intelligence agencies are. Completely the opposite. Totally, totally the opposite. When you take an honest look at our intelligence communities and how they performed for the last 50 years. Tomorrow, I don't have time today, I'm going to take you on a tour of the FBI, the CIA, the National Security Agency, and what they've done to people's lives in America, to every single anti-war group, to every single black group, to every single environmental group. And this takes tens of thousands of FBI agents, which means that the entire agency, with few exceptions, willingly went along with illegal surveillance. Edward Snowden showed that they were illegally surveilling every American, every email, every photograph, everything you were doing. They even went so far, get this, to go into your porn records and look at everything that you've ever watched in the way of porn on the internet, and then categorize it, trying to find what your fetishes or sexual desires are. Did you know that? For those who use porn, it's number one reason people go to the internet. Now, I have my own views on porn, and I don't subscribe to needing this, as a lot of people do, but that's not a condemnation of people who do need it. But why should the government know what your fetishes are? Why should the government know what movies you're downloading on Netflix? Why should the government know what books you're taking out of a library or purchasing? Why should they know that? What is the purpose of that? That's the rest of it. So Hannity being a hyper-ultra-nationalist on steroids, where you never look, pull back far enough to look at the truth of all these things that you glamorize and protect, and you think there's just a few bad apples at the top who have their own political agenda, there's always been bad throughout the entire system. And this is not new, but I'll go into this in great depth tomorrow. Finally, a few thoughts for a friend of mine. On Thursday, Jim and his wife attended the limited private screening in New York of what a really core activist. It was packed immediately when I announced it, and we had a lot of people who wanted to come. I'm sorry you couldn't, but that'll be resolved in mid-January. And these are people who themselves don't have to be inspired to adjust their views on social issues. They're wired into them. And then the next day, or Saturday, Jim ended up having a very serious heart condition and had to have emergency stents put in. Now, stents, though they can certainly save a life, they're not curative of anything. They're merely a palliative. They help you in an emergency situation. And instead of being one of the people who said, anything I must do right now, I will do to save my life, it was, well, I don't need to, you know, I've got my career, I've got, you know, responsibilities, and that's what I'm going to put my energy in. Do you have any idea how many times I've heard this from people I know and people who are close to me and people who are strangers? Why is it in our society, when you're faced with imminent death, you would rather make sure that you get to the office the next day than get to what you need to do to save your life? This is how conditioned people are. Now, it's easier for me to work with an uneducated person who does not have the advantages of a high level of academic conditioning, success in a career, acknowledgement, and hence somehow this immortal sense that their presence is always needed. Everybody dies. We all do. Nobody makes that alive. But we live beyond Thoreau and Eurydicles and Sophocles and Plato and Buddha and Christ and Muhammad. We live beyond all of them. And we'll live beyond everyone who's here now. So when you do have a moment in time that you must address 100% of your energy to your own self, do so, because the job will still be there tomorrow. It's just someone else to take your place. And in time, no matter how valuable you were when you were there, it'll be a chance for someone else to show their value. So we're not irreplaceable. And we like to think that we are. And so what we're going to do is tomorrow, I'm going to bring on the program, if we get our phone system, which is now in today, hooked up. So we have a new state-of-the-art audio system. So it sounds like everyone's on a microphone when they're calling instead of a phone or Skype, which has that kind of tinny quality. And we'll show you people who decided to make their life number one. No matter what anyone suggested and said, they weren't going to go back to the work. Because you can't. You have no idea how bad disease is compared to your efforts. Disease is really radical. I mean, it's hyper-radical on steroids when you have any disease. And you're coming from an ultra-conservative. Well, I don't want to be too radical about this healing stuff. I don't want to get too much energy. I don't want to give too many I can't take that much food. I can't drink all those juices. It's just too much. Too much compared to death? Boy, there's a need for a reality check. Whoa. Tomorrow, you'll hear from people who made the choice and the results. And I'll then explain my study of showing you what happens when you have disease and you don't put the energy into healing that already exists into diseasing. That's tomorrow. We're out of time, however. I want to thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.